This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by Ergo Pouch, organic tog-rated sleepwear designed for babies and kids to sleep naturally. And right now you can get 20% off site-wide with the code RON20. But be quick, this offer is only available from February 24th to March 10th. Wake up and start the day with the new Breakfast Club collection, a gorgeous limited edition range available to shop now at ergopouch.com.au. Sarah Blatchford has had to do a lot of hard things. She navigated a terrifying infection that had her daughter in hospital for a week just as she was returning to paid work. She and her family quickly moved to the tiny UK island of Guernsey to care for and spend time with her father-in-law, who was dying from motor neuron disease. And during what would be a complex journey trying to conceive her second baby, she navigated the unique and heartbreaking challenge of terminating for medical reasons. In amongst it, a colleague innocently congratulated her for the pregnancy she no longer held. She had to pick out a tiny urn for the baby she'd never get to know, and she had to leave a workplace she could no longer face. But, as always, there's been beauty among the pain. There's been joy and love and creativity and welcoming another living baby. There's been delighting in the newborn phase and creating art too. And some tales don't deserve my over-explaining. Instead, they're better told from the person who's lived to tell them. So I'll let Sarah do that. I'm Lucinda. This is Ready or Not. And here is the wise and warm, Sarah Blatchford.
Sarah, a bit of a theme that's coming up in these conversations lately and the emails that follow when I jump on with my guests is the idea of entering motherhood and I guess being surprised by what we end up finding and what ends up coming into our journey. If you look back, when you talked to me about feeling like you went into motherhood quite naively, what do you think you expected when you think about that pre-pregnant self entering motherhood?
I definitely would say that I thought about having a baby, but I don't think I thought much beyond that. I don't think people say like, I want to have a baby. They don't say I want to have a child. And then beyond that, you don't really picture it. You picture the maternity leave. And I don't really think I thought about what happened beyond maternity leave or even during maternity leave. I just thought, oh, you look after the baby and all those sorts of things. But I really don't think I put a lot of thought into it. But I would say it's largely because I wasn't having conversations about it. I wasn't really surrounded by friends who had babies. I've got two older brothers. And look, my sister-in-law, I probably may have chatted with a bit about it, but I wasn't really engaging in those conversations either. So I would say I was incredibly naive with what I was heading into.
I think a lot of us can agree and attest to that statement. So you're not alone there. Let's take it back to your 20s. You finish school. What happens next as you start to move through your career?
So I finished school and went straight to uni. I actually started doing a media studies degree, but then switched over into fine arts and loved doing that. But like I'm sure with a lot of other people who do similar degrees, I didn't know what to do with it. So I just took the career in retail that I had at that time and just followed through with it into a head office role and started fumbling my way through various roles in like a support office context. So I started doing accounts payable, which is it was a weird choice. It was just an opening and I thought, oh yeah, it's been now I can see in my early 40s, it's my go-to of like, oh yeah, like how hard can it be? I'll give it a go. So gave that a go, learnt a lot really quickly. And just as every now and then a job would open, I'd be like, oh yeah, give it a go. Take that one. So I ended up having like a really, really fun and rich career for all of my 20s in retail in different roles. So there was a bit of like design work and merchandise planning and buying, lots of travel, lots of the fun stuff, but I burnt out well and truly by like my late 20s with all of the travel.
The term burnout wouldn't have been even really in the zeitgeist then, I wouldn't have thought. How did you identify how you were feeling, and how did you then address a bit of a career change?
There was a, I can pinpoint it. There was a day, so I was working, I think it was like a 9 kilometer drive or something. Public transport to and from was not great. And I drove home one day and it had taken me an hour and a half going across the city. I walked in the door and I had my Tupperware container from lunch and I just piffed it across the room. Like it was one of those moments of just like, ah, like you want to scream into a pillow, whatever it is. And I just snapped. I was like, oh, I don't want to do that every day. Again, it's driving me mad. I would actually walk home some days and it was faster than driving. And it was a nice walk. So I just knew something had to change. And my now husband is very pragmatic with those sorts of things. So he's like, write a list. What are things that you're curious about? I did that. And then we chatted and wrote, you know, with another column, what have you got to do to get to these things? And just really spent some time thinking about what the next step is and doing my dip ed. It was actually the last year you could do it and study in 1 year.
I was wondering that from the email because I thought, oh, that was quick. But there was a time where you could just do 1 year of studies and become a teacher.
Yeah, it was the last
for your postgrad, that is.
Yeah, for ACU, I think a lot of the other unis had stopped doing it and they were the last one, and that was walking distance from where we lived at the time. So I thought, look, this is going to be a redo of uni. I had probably like not the best time first time round at uni. There was some stuff going on at home. So I was like, this is a full redo. I get a year where I get to go back to uni, soak it all up, restart. And teaching is something I was always really curious about. Someone asked me, I think in prep or grade one, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And a like art teacher came out of my mouth before I could even think. It was just something I loved and was really curious about. So I just went for it.
And you did this at the age of 30, and I think you're going to buck this trend, but that can often be when we feel real pressure to sort of have our careers together if we want to embark on this motherhood journey. I have a feeling that you had a bit more of a pragmatic approach to that. Talk to me about how you felt about going back to study what people would perceive as a bit later and how motherhood interacted with your thoughts and your plans there.
Motherhood, I would say, was probably like on the horizon, but I knew it wasn't going to happen for a couple of years. I would say like I'm pretty traditional and so is my husband. So he always thought like marriage would come first, and he's a planner and very, very practical. I am too. And that year that I decided to go back and study is when we got engaged anyway. So I was like, right, long engagement, we'll sort of do these things. I'll study, start work, and then get that like maybe a year or two in, and then we'll think about baby. So, and that's really what I thought. I think that probably did set me up for expecting motherhood to be really linear, because I was such a planner, and everything that I planned out up until trying for baby number one went really smoothly. Like I was very, very lucky.
And so you graduate from your dip ed, I think it used to be called.
Yeah.
Talk to us about then re-entering the workforce in a new industry and starting to climb the ladder and go into leadership positions there.
Yeah, so it was interesting because I would say most people in that dip ed were either a lot younger or a lot older than me. I didn't really find anyone else my age, and there was a few hundred people doing it. I sparked up a few really close friends and they were, I don't know, maybe 5 years younger. So again, like thinking about really different stuff. But I treated that year of study like it was my job, you know, like you go in and you can't switch that kind of mentality off. So when it came to I'm going to finish study and I need to be walking into a full-time job, I've got a mortgage, things to pay for, I went so hard trying to make sure that I set up that job. And I did. I landed a job at a really large co-ed school that I was really, really happy with. It wasn't an ongoing role. It was actually a maternity leave cover for 6 months. But yeah, I started that next year afresh with a role in a really supportive and great school. So I was quite lucky to walk into that rather than starting off doing CRT and whatever else that might have looked like, and what it did look like for most of my friends.
Yeah. And then so fast forward a few years, and I think that's when the motherhood chat starts to enter the picture. Talk to me about falling pregnant and navigating pregnancy alongside your new role.
Yeah. So in my third year, I started as faculty head. So I'm an art teacher, and that job opened up in my second year. And I thought again, oh, yeah, Okay, great. I actually thought I've really got the skill set for this because of my previous career. And although only a third year teacher, I just was like, yeah, we're going for it. So I did. And then about, I think, maybe term one or two, I was like, I think we're ready to go. So we started trying and I got pregnant, I think, on the second try. It was just one of those things where I was quite surprised by that because I just thought this might be tricky. Like I just had had so many stories surrounding me that, you know, like it doesn't just happen and whatever. So I was really surprised and very thankful that we had a very easy pregnancy. I felt sick and all of those things, but there weren't any complications the whole way through. It just ran smoothly. And then end of term one in my fourth year of teaching, I went off on mat leave.
Yeah. The education industry, I feel like, is quite a good place for mums and parents taking leave. Did you feel pretty well supported and, I guess, empowered by your maternity leave plan and returning to work?
I did. Like, I had seen so many other women in such a women-led industry come and go on mat leave, and some of them come back doing CRT, some of them come back part-time. Like, that in itself is a little bit tricky, but they're in such a big school with over, I think, you know, about 100 teaching staff and then other support staff. There's a revolving door of just women clocking on and off on mat leave. So I thought, well, I didn't give it much thought, to be honest. I sort of like, I know I'll come back. This role will be here.
Yeah,
I was really, really lucky and very well supported, I would say, going off on leave. The principal was great, you know, would sort of check in if he saw me in the yard. How's it all going? Where are you up to? It was lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so then you eventually meet your baby Penelope. What do you recall most about early motherhood?
Look, I would say the pregnancy went well. The birth was really difficult. I wouldn't say it was, oh, look, at the time I would say it was difficult. Now that I've had a second one that was positive, I would say it was pretty traumatic. But overall, everyone came out fine, largely unscathed and healthy. Like a long labour, pushed for over 3 hours, lots of intervention, but was really surprised with early motherhood. That I remember those first few weeks, I literally felt like I'd been in a car accident or something. Like my body felt so banged up. And I thought it was so weird that no one treated me like I'd been in the accident. It was like it hadn't happened. It was just a really weird time. And so I was sort of walking around with this, trying to get my head around, trying to understand like where do I fit in this picture now? It was a really strange time. I loved maternity leave, but it was that paradox of like, I desperately missed work. I missed the social part of it. I loved, love, love, loved that job. But at the same time, I filled my days and I loved being away from it. I loved my time with Penelope.
Yeah.
I didn't have any issues with postpartum depression or anything. I would say I had a fair amount of anxiety.
Yeah.
Around like breastfeeding and all those other things. She took a long time to gain weight and all of those things now I can kind of glaze over. But when I was in it, it was a lot.
Yeah, all consuming. You all say consuming. That you felt a bit banged up and like your body had been through this massive thing, which it had, but that no one could really see that. Do you think with hindsight that sort of stops you getting the support you need to recover? Because it's almost like it's society doesn't quite validate our need for rest and what we've been through sometimes with these, what could maybe be described as a traumatic or semi-traumatic birth.
I think that people seem to acknowledge it, but then there isn't a follow through by most, unless it's maybe a girlfriend or a close friend who really gets it and has probably been through it. I feel like they talk about it in the hospital. You'll talk about it with your GP or whoever it might be, and then you hear it on podcasts or whatever it is. But unless you're really lucky to have that kind of village and support network around you, or maybe that you can afford a doula or something like that, you kind of almost need to facilitate that care. Well, you do. You need to facilitate that your care yourself. So it's kind of, it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I have a very supportive husband. He's incredible. But that was a very steep learning curve, I would say, for our relationship. Something I did not see coming at all.
Yeah.
Of me being able to ask for help, but also being able to receive it.
Yeah. So do you think it was a challenge for you to really, I guess, ask for what you needed and feel supported properly in that time?
Yeah. So hard. Absolutely. Yeah. Because I just felt like all the focus was on the baby and it was my role to look after her And that's,
no one's ever actually put it like that. It's so true. It's like you're almost playing a character, like this new baby's here and you've got to play mum. And that's just how it is.
Well, I modeled what, I mean, I did what was modeled for me as well. Like that was, my mum always called it like burnt chop syndrome, you know, like that's what the mum does. You provide for everyone else first and you take what's left at the end. And I don't agree with that, but you just do certain things instinctively, I suppose.
And so you had missed work and missed the social aspect of being at work. I want you to now cast your mind to just before you're actually returning to paid work. How were you feeling about it then and how did it then play out?
I felt like a rush to go back and I don't know what it was. I think maybe like the terms with school, it just made sense to me to accommodate everyone else to go back for term one because that's the easiest thing to do, right? I've since seen other friends do it very differently of things that work for them and their family. And I don't know, again, why it didn't just occur to me to not take a full 12 months because I took 9 instead, or maybe 8, I think. And so we wanted to get Penelope into daycare. So that then started at 7 months and all of the lovely, joyful gifts that come with starting daycare trickled into our household. At the 7 month mark, she started getting sick. We all started getting sick, all of those things. And I could have really just slowed it down and gone back after Easter or whatever it might be. But I found it very difficult to slow that momentum.
Yeah. And what did it look like? So you returned to work. There's already some sicknesses that have been entering the house. What did it look like if someone had to have a sick day? Was it sharing with your partner? Was it all on you? What were those early days of returning to work like?
At the time, my husband was like sort of freelance. So I had all of the sick leave up my sleeve and I went back in full-time leadership capacity. If there was a sick day, like if he took one, he didn't get paid basically. And then there was a slow-on effect for his role. So most of the time it was me. Because again, that's just kind of what made sense at the time. And that was really difficult because she got an ear infection very early on, which evolved into something actually really serious. But it was, I felt just panicked that I was letting everyone down. And I would say that's actually when postpartum anxiety really sort of started for me. It wasn't actually when I was on maternity leave. It was the confusion and the pressure of going back to work that was really difficult.
Yeah. So in our email, there's a few things that stood out from this period. One was that, as you've just mentioned, you don't know why with hindsight you went back at that time and you don't know why you felt like you had to go back full time, but you did. And also that Penelope had a pretty decent health scare, which you've just touched on at about 4 weeks after your return to work. Can you tell us about all that? You're navigating full-time work, a baby, something pretty serious that ends up with you all in hospital for a week.
Yeah. So she picked up a nasty ear infection that seemed to fix itself. I think we initially went into the children's because she had that really high temperature that with the little baby freaks you out like nothing else. I just sort of thought like if her temperature gets any high, she's going to explode. It was like, I need to be able to do something. But we went into the children's, nothing really came of it. I think they kind of looked at us and were like, this is not a huge priority. There's other stuff going on. Went home and then maybe a week later, she would have one day at home a week with my mum, which so lucky to be able to do that. And I got home, I think it must have been a Thursday, and I looked at Penelope and her face just didn't look right. And I knew she'd sort of still been struggling with a little bit of a cold or something. But I just was like, Mum, look at her face. Like something, one side just wasn't moving properly. I called my brother, he's actually worked at the children's as an emergency nurse. And I was like, you've got kids, what do I do? Like I just almost didn't back myself enough to do anything about it. I don't know. And then husband got home and he's just like, yeah, no, that's not right. So we went back to the children's and I just sort of thought that, I don't know, nothing would happen and we'd be back that evening. But I didn't actually leave the building for a week. We got in there and they thought it was some sort of palsy because by then literally half of her face was just dropping and not moving at all. And so the neuro team were involved. And as soon as anyone mentions that, you just get rushed straight through. And I sort of stood, I think it was the juxtaposition of a few weeks prior when we were sort of like, don't get me wrong, they didn't laugh us off, but it was like, we're fine, it's just a cold, to getting like a fast pass all the way through and getting a bed and all those things. I just think something's really not right here at all. And, you know, watching someone so tiny getting sedated and strapped to a board for an MRI and all those sorts of things, it ended up, I think after 4 days in there, they realized she had mastoiditis, which is like a infection. The ear infection had got into the bone behind her ear. I'm sorry if I'm like completely messing this up, if anyone listening is of
this
a medical
is not
profession.
Medical advice, we'll say that. Yeah, this is, just
this
your
is my
experience.
Spin on things. And it was basically pressing on her facial nerve. So that's what was happening. So they operated, drained it, did a whole lot of things. So that happened after, I think, yeah, we'd been in there for a week. And God, you're just looking at your baby's face thinking like, are you going to smile the same at me again? Are we going to fix you? So it was really, really scary. I think that then set me on a trajectory with postnatal anxiety that I just didn't anticipate, because I felt that had come about from me putting her in daycare.
Yeah. Oh, that must have felt almost like another return to work after this hospital experience. And you mentioned postnatal anxiety. Yeah. How does that sort of play out in the weeks and months that follow this pretty decent health scare that I'm sure rocked you quite a lot?
Yeah, well, it didn't play out particularly well, because you're trying to get back into the swing of things at work, and I've just randomly taken a week off, and that's taken a week off of my year 12 class and all of those things. I didn't have a computer with me, let alone the time to, you know, be leaving classes behind or anything like that. But anyway, school were amazing about it. Got back to work as best as I could, but this is early 2020. So if we're thinking about what's happening and swirling around at that time, I think there were some rumours and things going on about COVID at the time. And I really felt like, oh my God, there was like this impending sense of doom. I was just like, this kind of sickness thing is coming for me. I don't know. It was a really, really weird anxiety-inducing time.
Yeah.
And I think that term ended a week early with kids getting sent home. There was sort of those few weeks where we're like, oh, we're going into lockdown, what's happening, what's not? And then it happened. So I sort of feel like my return to school or to work, it really just didn't happen. It was this fumbled way through term one. And then we were all in lockdown and stuck at home.
And so were you working with your husband around Penelope, or what did that look like working from home?
Yeah, so working from home, it actually made things a little bit better, because it made it best of both worlds. I was working full time but managed to see her all the time, and I knew that she was safe and at home, and my husband couldn't work, so I can't even remember what it was called. Was it like Job Keeper or whatever? So nice that this is a distant memory, but he looked after her full time. So like,
and you didn't have to deal with that. I mean, I'm sure you were nervous about COVID sickness, but I'm thinking that sending her off to daycare after what you'd been through at the hospital would have been scary. So at least you didn't have to do that, even though it wasn't a perfect world in COVID.
Yes. I was like, I kind of loved that year. We had our moments just like everyone else. And of course I had my moments of like feeling very envious of my friends who didn't have kids and were, you know, able to do all these like workouts and all those sort of things that year. But I have no complaints about it at all, to be perfectly honest. It was a really nice year. I got to go upstairs on my morning tea break and see her first steps and all of those fun things of like having lunch together, and like, what a beautiful time. So it made me slow down, and it actually, I feel like, corrected that return to work that was earlier, probably too early.
Yeah.
I think. So
and
I'm
then
thankful for that.
Later that year, things take a pretty big turn in your family with a phone call that you receive from your father-in-law. Can you tell us about what happens next? Now, if you're a tired parent, you know how tricky it can be to figure out what your little one should sleep in, especially when the temperature's changing, and especially in those early days of navigating kids' sleep and kids' temperatures and all those really fun things that cause a lot of stress.
That's where Ergo Pouch comes in and makes life so much easier. Their organic, tog-rated sleepwear is designed to take the guesswork out of dressing your child for sleep, with safe sleep-approved options for newborns up to 6-year-olds. I love that their range isn't just practical, it's also beautiful. And with summer freshly behind us, their Breakfast Club collection is the perfect way to refresh your little one's sleepwear. The collection features two adorable food-inspired prints, Petit Pretzel, a boulangerie-style design with tiny pretzels on a blue base, and Bon Appetit, a playful mix of breakfast favourites like eggs and croissants on a soft cream background. And here's something to sweeten the deal with your breakfast spread. Right now, you can get 20% off site-wide with the code RON20, that's RON20. But hurry, this offer is only available from February 24 to March 10. Excludes sales items, Lyra convertible cot, deluxe mattress, gift vouchers, multi-buys and gift packs. Wake up with the Breakfast Club collection at ergopouch.com.au.
So I remember it was like we'd been for a walk around the park nearby. We were all waiting for the news that second epic lockdown was about to end. It was a Sunday night where we were told it's going to end, and it didn't. So we were all sitting around feeling a bit deflated, to put it nicely, and we get a call instead from my father-in-law, who was in Malaysia at the time with his partner. They had sort of got stuck there. That's where her family was. And I mean, he called a lot, so we didn't think anything of it. And then we could tell something was off, and he revealed to us that he had just been diagnosed with motor neuron disorder. So that was really shocking. But then to follow it up, he asked us if we would move to the UK, which is where my husband's from, to join him there and I guess just spend as much time together as possible. He'd met Penelope when she was 3 months old for a few days. He'd flown over, but that was sort of it. Like, none of us had had the opportunity to see each other. So within 4 weeks of that phone call, we'd arrived over there. Yeah, it was a real whirlwind.
You get off that phone call, I imagine you're in shock. I imagine your husband in even more shock. Talk us through those next 4 weeks. I imagine there was a lot of emotions of, yes, wanting to be there, but also feeling like, I don't know, some of your first year of parenting was taken away from you, and also feeling totally uprooted, like you had to move your whole life across the country while also feeling like it was an important thing to do. Can you talk to us about the emotions of that time?
It was 4 weeks that felt like 4 months jammed into it. You know, every day felt like an emotional roller coaster, because there were all of those things of like, I need to get there as quickly as I can, and I don't want to leave at all. And what about this? What if that? My family won't see her for as long as we're there, but I want to be there for my father-in-law. And what happens if this? And it was at a time where we had to literally sign a waiver with the government that if we get stuck, we can't rely on you to help us get back. You know, we had an entire plane to ourselves when we left. It was a really, really weird thing. And it felt like it was a really strange time when there was so much uncertainty, like no vaccines or anything. And I just sort of thought, like, what if this is it? Like, what if we leave and we can't get back? Because it felt like, if I don't know, if these lockdowns and things can happen, like anything can happen. So every decision feels really important. And I had moments of, I said out loud, like, I don't want to go, but we went, you know, and I'm glad that we did.
Yeah.
But it was really, really, really hard.
And so you get there, and I assume that means you've taken a pause from your job.
Yes.
What is it like when you're actually there? Not only are you navigating the decline of your father-in-law, as I told you off air, I've experienced motor neuron disease pretty intimately through one of my best teenage friend's stepdads. And I've seen that decline, which is hard enough in and of itself, let alone when it's family. But you're also raising your baby and you've had to step away from the job that you love. Tell us about your time there.
It was a weird time. It wasn't, so when I say UK, it was actually Guernsey, which is a place where I'd mention it and most people are like, oh yeah, no one's actually heard of it. It's a tiny, tiny island off the coast of France, which is British, but I think it's like half the size of Phillip Island. Like, it's very small but densely populated. So yeah, kind of like small country town vibes. I don't know. So you're sort of getting to this place where getting stuff done and meeting people and getting around is really hard. Like, you've got these tiny little laneways, all of the street signs are in French. Like, it was navigating a completely new terrain with a 1.5-year-old.
Yeah.
And people were sort of asking me questions of like, are you going to work while you're here? And I was like, who looks after the baby? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. And so I just sort of, I had to figure out what my role was amongst it pretty quickly. And I think we sort of, as a family unit, decided that I would be someone that could be around with my father-in-law day to day, is like someone who could pop in, help, whatever that looked like, support his wife. And I don't know, there's nothing that can bring joy to a difficult situation like a 1.5-year-old. You know, they walk into the room and that's like the spark and the joy that everyone needs in a really hard time. So, but yeah, it was really difficult. Trevor had, I didn't realize this, but there's different types of motor neuron, and he had the most aggressive type that actually sort of more attacks the throat. So he was walking around and very mobile, but lost his ability to talk and to swallow and all those sorts of things. So it was more about like getting nutrition in and being able to speak and breathe that were the biggest worries. So it was a really tricky year. About 6 months in, he got like a feeding tube, like it's in his stomach, the peg. He had that surgery, and then after that it felt like a really rapid decline, and he actually passed away a month before we left. So sort of to be there for that almost exactly 12-month period was just the, it's hard to put it into words. I couldn't actually put it into words. So I made a photo book for my husband that was just called, I think, Little Island Big Feelings, of just like the nicest photos, because we did. We had some beautiful moments there, but it was the most intense 12 months of my life.
I'm trying not to cry, but does it almost feel not real now? Like, I can imagine that feels like it didn't actually happen.
Weird dream.
Yeah.
A weird dream, because it is a really magical place. Like, to see this island is so beautiful. And I know I put things up on Instagram, and I would only put the nice things, obviously. And I look back at them, and I've got a lot of those stories still saved, because it just looks like this magical place.
Yeah.
And those are the bits that we've chosen to remember. We've got beautiful photos and videos of Penelope with her grandpa. And like, we're so lucky that we got that year of him spending time with her.
Yeah.
And yes, she missed out on time with my family here, but I don't know, we wouldn't change it. Yeah. I don't think.
The weird thing about hard times too is, I think, because it brings you together in some ways, there is a lot of beauty in it. So I can imagine when you reflect on that, you see both those beautiful moments and those special times, and then also the pain.
Yeah. And there was like a lot of resentment when we came back and all those sorts of things and the weird stages of grief. So don't get me wrong, I know I sound like I'm romanticizing it almost now, but I feel like that's what you have to do in order to process it, because you have to just be able to see like the amazing parts of it rather than dwell on the really difficult bits, because there were some bits. I think a day after we got an apartment that we rented, like the island went into lockdown. We didn't have any furniture. We literally had like a big cardboard box and nothing, like no beds, nothing, just a porta cot and a few things, and you can't get stuff delivered because it's just like, so navigating all of those things, trying to organize to get flights home. Yeah. It was stress like I've never experienced nor want to experience ever again. So to just focus on the amazing parts, it's just a lot nicer to do that, I think.
Yeah, fair enough too. So then you get home, and I feel like you've had all these different phases that would feel like different types of matrescence and like these huge life moments, and they're almost different iterations of returning to work after baby, returning to work after being seriously worried about your baby in hospital, and then returning to work after this, after losing your father-in-law and watching his decline so intimately. You get home. Talk us through that next part of your journey.
The bit that had kept me going while we were away was, as soon as I get home, like, I can return to normal because I can go back to work. I can see my friends. It was that sort of, I think, COVID thing that like things will go back to normal, that like line we kept on telling ourselves. And I got back to work, and it's like I was chasing something that didn't exist anymore. Like, I just kept on trying to get back into that flow that I knew free baby. And, you know, she was 2.5 by this stage and it just didn't exist. I spent a whole year feeling like I was losing it because I just kept on trying to get something to click that just didn't even exist anymore. And it took me a long time to see that. It was like I had changed. I don't think the job had changed as much, but I wasn't the same person. So little things that used to not bother me, like kids being naughty and whatever might happen in a classroom, like it would really set me off. And I wasn't like the happy, joyful teacher anymore.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was like...
Do you think you'd almost done too much caregiving, perhaps? Because teaching is a form of that. Was it like a compassion fatigue thing, do you think?
Fatigue beyond. Like I think I had just been doing so much of that and not filling up my own cup. Like there was nothing left to give.
Yeah.
It's like that feeling you get with your own kids when you're sort of really tired at the end of the day and they could do that little thing and you can just be like, and it can, the small things that can set you up. I felt like that all the time. And I just sort of knew, I think probably after about 6 months, I was just like, this is just not fun. I'm not loving this. And this is probably not the answer of me getting my groove back, whatever you want to call it. And we'd also decided once we got back to try for our second baby because we didn't want to do it whilst we were away. So those plans had been on hold. And after I think probably about 5 or 6 months of trying and it not working, I just knew within myself it wasn't happening because I was stressed. I really felt like I had that adrenal fatigue. I was
short-tempered. That exact word came to my mind when you said that. I was just thinking adrenal fatigue.
Totally. Like had lost a lot of weight, was just like stressed out all the time, not sleeping. And so it's no wonder, again, like late 30s, I'm not getting pregnant. What a surprise. So I just told school that I wanted to step down from my leadership role and probably go part-time the following year. And I think as soon as I did it, it's like my whole body just relaxed. And then we got pregnant. I think like within a week of it all happening, it was just like I needed to just give in to it, I think. And it was almost like giving in to motherhood, like stop fighting it and just relax and ease into it. And my body went along with things. So, yeah.
Your next challenge then came pretty soon after. You fall pregnant and I guess the universe decides to deliver you another challenge.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through what happens next?
So I had two girlfriends in my same office in my faculty that I knew were both trying at the same time. And we all got back, I think, from the school holidays or something like that. And we're all just sort of looking at each other like each of us had news. And then it was like one of those really joyful moments where it all comes out like everyone's pregnant at the same time. One of my girlfriends I know had been trying for a really long time. It was big news. We're all celebrating. As the weeks went by, it felt very different to my first pregnancy. Like not even just morning sickness. It was like a lot of cramping. I felt very uncomfortable. I don't know. Something was off. I probably tried to ignore it for as long as I could. But then we did the NIPT test like we did with our first. And I didn't think anything of it because we had had zero bumps in the road first time with Penelope. So it was just almost like a formality, like how lovely to be able to think like that. And I got a call from my GP who delivered the news and it was almost like, I don't know, I don't think I actually heard her words. It's like, it was a very, very strange phone call, but she delivered the news that Turner syndrome had been flagged. I don't even know what that was. Like, again, what a lovely existence to not know about these genetic disorders. But I immediately start Googling and realize, well, one, it's a girl because it's only a condition that affects females. So that is not how I wanted to find out the gender of our baby. But we sort of stumbled through a few days of figuring out what we do. And, you know, people are so kind and they're just like, you know, these tests can be wrong. And so then you start Googling, like, what's the accuracy rate and blah, blah, blah. And is this just a bit of, you know, like, this is our baby. This is our good luck that everyone kept on saying, like, you deserve a win. So I just didn't think it could have been true. But then we went in for our first scan. And before they even said anything, I could just tell something was really, really wrong on the scan with the fluid on the back of the neck that they measure. I think it's meant to be around 2 mL or it was like 11
or something.
It was again, and like have zero medical knowledge, and I could just see something was not okay. And that was a really hard day, because I think they looked at me expecting, like, do you want to do an amniocentesis? Do you want to do more testing? Whatever it was, but I just knew I don't feel like I even needed to make the decision. Drew and I looked at each other and sort of knew what we wanted to do, and not what we wanted to do. I think we knew what we needed to do, because there was no way that pregnancy was viable. Yeah. And I didn't want to continue a pregnancy waiting for it to end, knowing it would.
Yeah. Do you think there was a sense of, like, that you'd been through a lot and you sort of need to have the decision on your terms or something? I'm trying to think of what you'd been through.
Yeah. Control, maybe.
Yeah.
Or denial as well. Yeah. Like, I want to fix this. Yeah. I couldn't imagine going for weeks to just sort of see what my body naturally does and things. And for women who are now in certain places of the world have to do that, like, I can't say, which is one of the reasons I reached out, because I think it's so important that we have these conversations and people are vulnerable and share their experiences, because to go through that termination for medical reasons was hands down the hardest thing I'll ever do.
Yeah.
Because it's a weird thing. It's not a miscarriage, which a lot of people categorize it as. It's not a, I don't know, I feel like it's this thing that falls into this abyss of, like, nothingness, because no one really knows what to say about it. No one really talks about it. To be able to actually find resources to listen to at the time that made me feel some sort of sense of connection with another human.
Yeah.
To know that you're not the only one was really hard.
Mm.
I'm yet to sort of meet someone else who's been through a similar experience, although I know plenty of women who have had some really, really difficult journeys with pregnancy loss. It was a lot. So the women's were fantastic. We went in and saw the genetic counsellors, and all in all, they were lucky enough to fit me in pretty quickly. I think I had maybe a week left before they couldn't do a surgical abortion anymore. I think there was, like, a cutoff, and I was very, very close on that. You have to sign dotted lines. It's not like, it's just, I think my mum sort of started talking about her journey, and I had a few other people mention, you know, what a miscarriage was like. And you don't sign a dotted line like you do with this. Like, you have to go in and when they wheel you into theatre, they ask you what procedure you're in for the day. You have all those moments along the way where people talk to you about contraception and family violence things and all those things that they have to do when you go in for a termination to make sure that they're looking after women's health as they should. Their conversations, like, it was a very, very difficult day that I will never forget.
Yeah. So then you have the procedure, and then I guess this again is like another almost matrescence sort of postpartum, post-grief period that you have to navigate. What do the next few months look like? You're also a mother now, so you can't just wallow how you might have if you didn't have babies yet, which I imagine brought a lot of light too, because you had your beautiful girl there, but also it means you've got more responsibility, and then there's work. How did that all manifest over the coming months?
So this was thankfully really close to the end of the school year. I think I had to just, like, make my way through 2 weeks, and I still in those 2 weeks had people coming up to me who had just got wind that I was pregnant, and, you know, like, in front of a year seven class, like, congratulations, I've heard your good news. I think on my first day back after the termination happened, and that person meant very well and they didn't do anything wrong, but it was like a bullet, you know.
How did you handle that? Like, what did you say when people would say things like that?
I think your body just makes you smile and nod, and you just, like, you survive. Like, when you have to do it, you do.
You just say thanks and don't tell them otherwise.
Thanks, and you swallow it, and I don't know, maybe a bit of a nostril flare or something, but I'm in front of, like, 28 year sevens, and
it's
the same things we do in front of our kids when you're having a really bad day and you're feeling sad. Like, you cry in the cupboard if you have to. We did a little service for the baby at the women's, which I'm very thankful for, and had the remains kept, which I still have. But, you know, I was taking a call with a funeral home trying to pick out a little urn whilst all the other staff were going up and doing a PD. And then everyone would come back wanting to do Christmas lunch and things. And I just, it was a reality like no other. So I think I just got to the end of that year and I knew I just couldn't come back. I felt like in order to grieve, I just had to leave that job. I could not picture myself, whether people knew or not, or shame, or it had nothing to do with that. I was like, I need to leave this place and never come back, almost because I don't want any of this to be true. I don't want to have follow-up conversations. I wanted to just bury my head in the sand and figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I did. I fumbled my way through the next 6 months. I didn't go back to work. They were great. They gave me like a year of unpaid leave. Very, very understanding. People told me stories that I don't think they've ever shared with anyone. Women in confidence, you know, and I'm very thankful for all of those people, but I just think I needed some quiet. So I did casual work where I could just come and go and really like sneak through corridors to avoid people at bell time, sort of a thing. And then I used any spare time that I had to start painting. And I don't even know why I started doing it. Like, I'm a very artistic person and I've always done that, but I just picked up a brush and started doing that. And that I think somehow snowballed into the thing that was my way of processing my grief that 100% healed me. Like, I found myself through that.
Yeah.
But I just had a very quiet 6 months, and then I thought, I have to just get on with it whether I want to or not. And a job came up at a different school, which the irony of it all was a maternity leave cover. One of the reasons why I had left my previous job was because of those two friends who were pregnant. I couldn't be around and watch them go on mat leave. Like, I just, it wasn't an option. I didn't want to be the sad person in the corner when they had their happy day that they deserved. And I knew I wouldn't have been able to do that. So doing a stranger's maternity leave cover, I don't know, like, it still had a sting, but I just needed to push on and do something. So I started mid-year in a part-time role at a completely different school. And that was a real struggle initially, I would say the first 3 or 4 months, although I know I performed really well in the job because you get in there and it's like you put your mask on and you get on with things. I just remember mornings of like getting there, and I think I would sit there in a bit of a daze for 20 minutes of just like, what is my life and what am I doing? Because we started trying again immediately and it just wasn't happening. I knew something was really off with my body. I went to the GP and she just sort of was like, well, you're of that age, like come back in 6 months, sort of a thing. And I was not helpful at all, but I just, periods were off, something felt really wrong. And I think it was around about the time when I started that school, I went off and saw someone privately and realized that termination had left me with Ashman syndrome. So a whole lot of scar tissue that was stopping me from getting pregnant again. So it was quite nice to be in a new workplace where I didn't feel like I had the responsibilities of being social and being involved like I was previously. I could be really anonymous and just sort of do my thing, give limited information away. And I worked with an amazing team who were just incredible, but it was just that one step back in order to sort of disappear and survive, I think.
Yeah. So then you've got this new role, you're trying to conceive, you've identified that you have Ashman syndrome. How do we go from there to conceiving with the baby that's now in your arms, for anyone that can hear some little baby noises? Fern's joined us in this chat. What was the journey from A to B then?
I think having a little bit of a breather just gave me a drive. Like, I was so determined to have that second baby. I think I just had felt, I felt robbed. And so I sort of started on this journey of, again, just like pushing and pushing. We were very lucky enough to be able to see someone privately to rectify that scar tissue. Again, going into it, he was very direct and just sort of said, just might not work, that might be it. But thankfully everything went fine and I just said, we're just going straight into IVF. I don't know if I had, after that procedure, if I needed it, but again, it was like a control thing or needing to be as proactive as possible. And so, yeah, on started a few months of, anyone who's done IVF knows just how fun it is. The blood work, injections, breaking out in random hives from progesterone and all sorts of like fun, curly things. But I think it was the right decision because it just gave me a sense of like I was doing something. It wasn't that fumbling through just trying and like hoping for something to happen. I think I got 5 eggs, which ended up being 2 embryos. We did manage to conceive 1 month, which ended up being a chemical pregnancy. And then that was the same for that first embryo as well, initially took, and then they can just disappear, which although was not as hard as that enormous loss the December before, every time you see a positive on a pregnancy test that then disappears, feels like a loss.
Yeah, of course.
And it's going to be different for everyone, but they felt big. They felt enormous.
Yeah.
The second embryo, which was the last one, I had sort of decided by that stage I felt really, really done with people poking and prodding my body and just all of this going on. And I had decided I probably didn't want to do another retrieval, so that was going to be it. And very, very thankfully, that second and last embryo took. And here we go. So that started Fern's pregnancy. And I feel like everything shifted at that moment.
Were you able to enjoy the pregnancy from early on, or did it take some time, or were you nervous the whole way through?
I thought I was going to be nervous because I feel like I've listened to so many stories of people being rattled, and I definitely was nervous about doing the NIPT test again, which of course happened to fall the week between, I think, Christmas and New Year's, where everything was shut down, and I was like calling people like a lunatic trying to get results. That was the one thing. As soon as I got the all clear on that, I relaxed into it and enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was a lovely pregnancy, again, with all of like the unattractive moments of pregnancy. Wasn't fun, felt sick all the way up until, I don't know, 25 weeks or whatever, at least it stopped. But it was, I don't know, things shifted, and thank goodness they did, because I'm so glad I made all of those decisions and pushed for her and advocated for myself. Like if I think back to when I first became a mum, of stumbling around, feeling beat up and not being able to say, hey, I can't walk as fast as you, can we slow down, which I wouldn't have done at the time. I now have learned through all of this to really use my voice, not just like expect someone to hear a thought that's going on in my head. Advocate through the healthcare system, which you have to do. I just didn't even know that that was a thing. And just for myself in day-to-day life, whether that's like trying to figure out what my career looks like now, or if a job doesn't feel right, or if it doesn't fit in with what we're doing, you know, those are the thoughts that should be leading my decision rather than just fumbling through what I think it should look like and what I should be doing to please other people. It's completely changed me as a person.
Yeah. And you say that pregnancy almost sort of reignited you. How did your relationship to your job manifest in that time? Did you also reignite a passion for what you were doing at work, or were you sort of more focused on just getting through this pregnancy and embracing it?
Very distracted. Loved the job, and I would say gave it my all, but I knew that maternity leave quite poetically was ending, as I would be heading off on maternity leave anyway for someone else to return back after they'd had their mat leave. Like the timing of it all, I think I ended up finishing 2 weeks early because I just wanted to enjoy a bit of quiet time before having baby number two, and which ended up being a lot of quiet time because she ran over up until 42 weeks. But yeah. You know, the timing of it all was beautiful. Yeah. It really, really was. I don't know what the next step looks like. I feel like teaching in some senses has sailed, but maybe it just looks different. I just think I've changed too much to go back to being the person that I was, but it doesn't mean that it's over. It just means it looks different. So I'm taking the time at the moment to figure out what that looks like.
And what about second time motherhood? What's that been like so far?
It is so nice having a second baby because you go into it with, and especially when it's been so hard to meet them, the things that I found so the first time that I just would overwhelming and stressful, they're like my favourite parts now. The little moments where they're crying at 3 a.m. and you just get to tell them it's okay and snuggle up to them, and the sleep deprivation, again, hard, but it's fine. I don't even think about it. There are other challenges, like a five-year-old who is probably a little bit jealous that they're not the full center of the universe anymore.
Yeah.
Like there are new challenges and there are things that are so hard. That has been the real challenge, but it has brought so much joy. I have like a sense of gratitude you would not even believe. Like it's enormous. My heart has grown. It hasn't doubled in size. It's like it's exploded.
Oh, well, you've made my heart explode with this story. You've definitely made me feel things today. I've really enjoyed hearing your story, even though it's been a hard one to live out. And I'm glad to see your beautiful baby there on your chest. If you could go back and tell yourself one thing about the things that you'd have to navigate, or a bit of advice or a source of comfort for anyone out there that also has had to terminate for medical reasons or has navigated loss or has even navigated motor neuron disease, what would you go back and tell that version of yourself that was about to embark on this journey?
I think the most important thing I've learned through all of this is human connection. So asking people for help and sharing your story and listening to other people's. Because it's something I didn't go into motherhood doing, not really listening, you know, for people's advice, or the same with pregnancy loss. There were quite a few times where I had people try and share their pregnancy losses with me. One when I was pregnant the first time, and I couldn't hear it almost because I was worried I was going to catch it. It was a weird thing where I was worried they were going to jinx me. I didn't say any of that out loud, but I wish if I could go back, it would be to just shut up and listen to some other people when they're having their hard times.
Yeah.
It's ignited an enormous amount of compassion. You don't know what the person next to you is going through, you know, so just slow down, listen and talk as well, you know, all those things. That's all we have at the end of the day.
That's a beautiful sentiment to end with. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I know you have a page where you share your art on Instagram. If people want to find you there, where should they go?
Yeah, it's Sarah_N_Latchford. Oh my gosh, I've got a handful. This is why postpartum hair loss is a thing. Or if you just look up Sarah Blatchford on Instagram. I, funnily enough, have been offered a solo show next year, which is on Fern's birthday, which felt very...
Wow.
Again, poetic, the fact that the reason I started painting was my way of finding my way back to her. And then that's the date that they came up with. So
What date is that?
It's the 31st of July.
Oh,
Brunswick Street Gallery. We're looking forward to it. There's a lot of work to get done. So the sleepless nights with a paintbrush will continue.
Yes. Oh, amazing. Well, when that gets closer, we'll share it on the radio and on Instagram. Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.